A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking about the current state of Iran's enrichment program. Specifically, what form the highly enriched uranium believed to be buried at Isfahan is actually in. The consensus says it's stored as uranium hexafluoride gas, but nobody outside Iran can verify that. It could already be enriched further, or converted into other forms. And the core question is, if we assume the material is mostly gaseous and buried at Isfahan, what credible options exist for seizing it, transporting it overseas, and destroying it? That's a three-part military and logistical puzzle, and the answer to each part depends on the answer to the one before it.
The first thing to understand is why the "what form is it in?" question matters so much. If it's uranium hexafluoride gas, UF6, that's a nightmare to move. UF6 is stored in cylinders under pressure. It's corrosive, it's toxic, it reacts violently with moisture in the air. You can't just throw it in the back of a truck. But if it's been converted to uranium oxide powder, or cast into metal, or fabricated into actual weapon components, the seizure challenge changes completely. Each form has a different weight, a different container requirement, a different radiation signature, and a different timeline for what you can do with it once you have it.
The first problem is you don't know what you're grabbing until you're already there.
And there is the problem. Isfahan is not Fordo. Fordo is buried under a mountain near Qom, built into rock, famously hardened. Isfahan is a different facility. The Isfahan Nuclear Technology Center, sometimes called the INTC or the Isfahan Nuclear Site. It's a large complex with multiple buildings, including the uranium conversion facility. It's not as deeply buried as Fordow, but it's still heavily defended. It's in the middle of Iran, and it's surrounded by air defense systems. This is not a site you can approach casually.
Let's do the thing Herman loves doing. Walk me through the options. What are the credible ways to actually seize this material?
There are really only three broad approaches, and none of them are easy. Option 1 is a ground raid. Special forces insert, breach the storage site, secure the material, and extract. Option 2 is an air-delivered operation where you neutralize the site's defenses and bring in a heavy lift capacity to remove the material. Option 3 is what I'd call a denial operation. You don't remove the material, you destroy it in place. Each of these has been studied extensively, and there's a body of open-source analysis on this, including some very detailed work from the Institute for Science and International Security and from various military studies programs.
Start with the ground raid. That's the one everyone pictures.
And the model people usually point to is the Israeli raid on the Syrian reactor at Deir ez-Zor in 2007 or the Entebbe operation in 1976. But those were different in scale and objective. Seizing bulk nuclear material at Isfahan would require a force large enough to secure a multi-building complex, hold it against counterattack for potentially hours, locate the specific storage cylinders, verify they're intact, load them onto transport, and then extract through Iranian airspace or overland to a coast. We're talking about a battalion-sized element at minimum, probably several hundred operators, plus air support, plus a logistics tail.
They'd have to get there first. Iran is not Syria, geographically.
No, and that's the central challenge. Isfahan is roughly 340 kilometers south of Tehran, in the center of the country. From the nearest coastline, the Persian Gulf, you're looking at about 500 kilometers of overland travel through some of the most heavily defended airspace on the planet. A direct air insertion would require suppressing Iranian air defenses along the entire ingress route, which means this is not a quiet operation. The moment the first helicopter crosses the border, every radar in Iran lights up.
This stops being a raid, and starts being a small war.
And that's before we even talk about the material itself. UF6 cylinders are heavy. A standard 30-inch cylinder filled with UF6 weighs about 2.5 metric tons. If Iran has a significant stockpile, and the IAEA's last estimates before access was restricted suggested they had accumulated enough material for multiple weapons. We could be talking about moving multiple cylinders. You need heavy lift helicopters, probably CH-53s or similar, each capable of sling loading a single cylinder. Those helicopters are slow, they're vulnerable, and they need refueling. For an operation this deep into Iran, you'd need forward arming and refueling points, which means you need to hold territory along the route.
Which means ground forces holding a corridor. This is starting to sound less like a raid, and more like the opening phase of an invasion.
There's a reason this option is discussed in hushed tones. The military requirements are enormous. You'd need air superiority over central Iran for the duration of the operation, which means neutralizing not just the air defense network, but the Iranian Air Force itself. You'd need to suppress ballistic missile batteries that could target your extraction route. You'd need to deal with the IRGC ground forces that would certainly mobilize. And all of this has to happen fast, because the international political clock starts ticking the moment the first shot is fired.
What about the actual seizure moment? Say you get your people to the storage site. How do they even know which building, which room, which cylinders?
This is where intelligence becomes the single most critical variable. You need to know the exact layout of the facility, the specific storage location, the form the material is in, the security arrangements, the guard rotation, the response protocols. That requires human intelligence on the ground, either recruited assets or infiltrated operators. And it has to be current. A floor plan from 6 months ago is worthless if they move the material last week. The Iranians are not stupid. They know this material is a target, and they almost certainly move it periodically and maintain decoy storage sites.
You're saying the ground raid is essentially impossible.
I'm saying it's at the extreme edge of what's militarily feasible, and the conditions required to make it work. Perfect intelligence, complete air superiority, a compliant international environment are unlikely to align simultaneously. But I should note, there are analysts who disagree with me. Some argue that a smaller, more targeted operation could work, a team of perhaps 30 to 50 operators inserted covertly, focusing on sabotaging the material in place rather than removing it. That's a different profile.
Which brings us to option 2, air-delivered seizure. How is that different?
Option 2 doesn't require ground forces to hold territory. The idea is, you use precision strikes to destroy the air defenses around Isfahan, then bring in a heavy lift aircraft, a C-17 or a C-130, to land at Isfahan's airport or on a secured stretch of highway, load the material, and fly out. This avoids the overland extraction problem entirely. But it creates a new problem, which is that you're now landing a large, slow aircraft at a site that is still under threat from mobile air defense systems and ballistic missiles. And you need the runway intact.
You need the material to be at the airport, not at the nuclear facility.
The Isfahan nuclear site is about 15 kilometers from the Isfahan International Airport, so you still need a ground element to move the material from the storage site to the aircraft. That's a 15-kilometer convoy through potentially hostile urban terrain. Isfahan is a city of over 2 million people. You're not moving nuclear material through those streets without a fight.
Unless you bring the aircraft to the site instead.
That's where vertical takeoff and landing comes in. Marine Corps has been developing concepts around distributed operations with F-35Bs and MV-22 Ospreys. An MV-22 can carry about 9,000 kilograms internally, which is enough for a couple of UF-6 cylinders if they're not the largest format. But the Osprey has a combat radius of around 700 kilometers without refueling. From a carrier in the Arabian Sea, you're pushing that limit. From a land base in a neighboring country, you need that country's cooperation, which brings in a whole diplomatic dimension.
What about just destroying the material in place? That's option 3.
This is the option that gets the most serious discussion in military planning circles, because it's the most achievable. The objective shifts from take the material to render the material unusable for weapons production. For UF6 gas stored in cylinders, this is actually quite straightforward from a physics standpoint. You puncture the cylinders and the gas escapes. UF6 sublimates. It goes directly from solid to gas at atmospheric pressure, and when it hits moisture in the air, it forms a cloud of hydrofluoric acid and uranyl fluoride. The uranium is dispersed, and recovering it from the environment is extraordinarily difficult.
You just blow holes in the cylinders and leave.
But the engineering challenge is making sure you actually get all of it. If you only destroy 80% of the stockpile, Iran still has 20% of its material. For a weapons program, that's still significant. So you need to be certain you've located and destroyed every storage cylinder. That requires the same intelligence problem we already discussed, plus the challenge of verifying destruction after the fact. How do you know the cylinder you hit was full and not a decoy?
There's the environmental dimension. You're releasing a toxic gas cloud over a city of 2 million people.
This is the part that makes military planners very uncomfortable. UF6 is nasty stuff. When it reacts with moisture, it produces hydrofluoric acid, which is a severe respiratory hazard and can cause fatal pulmonary edema. The uranyl fluoride is also chemically toxic and, yes, radioactive. Though the radioactivity of enriched uranium is actually relatively low compared to fission products. The chemical toxicity is the bigger immediate concern. If you release a significant quantity of UF6 over Isfahan, you're looking at a civilian casualty event that would be measured in the hundreds or thousands, depending on wind conditions and how quickly the population can be evacuated.
Which is a war crime, depending on who's counting.
It would certainly be characterized that way by Iran and its allies, and it would create a massive international legal and political backlash. That's why some variants of the denial option propose using a different method. Thermite-based incendiary devices that would melt the cylinders and convert the UF6 into a less dispersible form, or even small nuclear devices designed to vaporize the material without a large fission yield. But each of these has its own complications.
Small nuclear devices. We're just going to leave that sitting there for a moment.
It's been discussed in the literature. A low-yield nuclear earth-penetrating weapon could theoretically destroy a deeply buried stockpile while minimizing surface effects. But using a nuclear weapon, even a small one, crosses a threshold that no country has crossed since 1945. The political cost would be incalculable. And it doesn't solve the verification problem. How do you confirm the material was destroyed and not just scattered?
Let's step back to the form question, because this is where it gets genuinely interesting. You said UF6 is gas under pressure. But if Iran has already converted it, and they have the conversion capability at Isfahan, that's literally what the facility was built for. What are the other possible forms?
The conversion chain matters here. You start with yellowcake, which is uranium oxide concentrate. That gets converted to UF6 for enrichment. After enrichment, you have enriched UF6. To make a weapon, you need to convert that back to uranium metal, which involves reducing the UF6 with calcium or magnesium, then casting and machining the metal into weapon components. Iran has the technical capability to do all of this. The question is whether they've done it.
If they've already converted to metal, the seizure problem changes.
Uranium metal is dense, about 19 grams per cubic centimeter, similar to gold. A weapon's worth of highly enriched uranium metal, say 15 to 25 kilograms, is about the size of a grapefruit. You can carry it in a backpack. If the material is in metal form, a small team could theoretically seize it and extract it without the heavy lift requirement. But the flip side is that metal is easier to hide, harder to locate, and much easier for Iran to disperse across multiple sites.
The gas assumption is almost the best case for a seizure operation, because at least you know it's in large, heavy, hard-to-move cylinders.
The gas form constrains Iran's ability to hide the material. Those cylinders are large, they require specific storage conditions, and they have a detectable signature. UF6 emits characteristic gamma radiation that can be detected by aerial surveillance. If Iran has converted to oxide powder or metal, the signature is different and the storage requirements are less demanding. They could distribute the material across dozens of sites, some of which might be in urban areas, schools, hospitals, the classic human shield approach.
The intelligence problem gets exponentially harder if they've converted.
We have to assume they've at least considered it. The Iranians have watched the international community debate their nuclear program for decades. They've seen operations like Stuxnet. They've seen the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. They've seen the sabotage at Natanz. They know their stockpile is a target. The rational thing for them to do is convert the material to a form that's easier to hide and disperse. That they may not have done so yet suggests either technical constraints, bureaucratic inertia, or a deliberate calculation that the gas form provides some deterrent value. Because if you attack the gas stockpile in situ, you risk creating an environmental catastrophe. The gas form is, in a perverse way, a shield. It makes the denial option, destroying it in place. much more costly in humanitarian terms. If the material were in metal form, destroying it in place would be relatively clean. You could use conventional explosives to melt and disperse the metal without creating a toxic gas cloud. The gas form forces any attacker to either accept massive civilian casualties or undertake the far more difficult task of seizing and removing the material intact.
That's a hell of a strategic calculation. Keep it as gas so that bombing it becomes a war crime.
It's not an accident. The Iranians have demonstrated sophisticated strategic thinking throughout their nuclear program. They've studied the precedents, Osirak in 1981, Deir-ez-Zor in 2007. They know that the international community's tolerance for military operations that cause civilian casualties is limited. The gas form of the stockpile is a form of insurance.
Which brings us back to the seizure question. If the gas form is a deliberate deterrent against destruction in place, then the only option that achieves the objective of permanently denying Iran the material is actually removing it. And we've established that a ground raid to seize gas cylinders is at the edge of feasibility.
There's one more dimension to this that we haven't discussed, and it's the overseas destination. The prompt asks about transport to an overseas location and destruction. Where would you take it?
I assume the United States or Israel.
Those are the obvious candidates, but each creates legal and political complications. If you bring highly enriched uranium to the United States, you're importing nuclear material without the consent of the country of origin. That's a violation of multiple international agreements, even if the material was produced in violation of those same agreements. Would have to navigate its own legal framework, including the Atomic Energy Act and various non-proliferation statutes. There's also the question of which U facility would receive it. The Y-12 National Security Complex in Tennessee handles highly enriched uranium, but receiving material of uncertain provenance and unknown chemical form would be a major security and safety challenge.
Israel doesn't have a facility designed to handle bulk UF6.
Israel has the Negev Nuclear Research Center near Dimona, but that facility is designed for plutonium production and handling, not for processing large quantities of enriched UF6. Israel could theoretically construct a handling capability, but that takes time. The more likely scenario, if Israel were the seizing party, would be to transfer the material to the United States under a bilateral arrangement. There's precedent for this. The U has received foreign origin nuclear material for disposition before, including material from Libya after Gaddafi's program was dismantled and from various research reactors around the world.
The Libya case is interesting. Walk me through that one.
In 2003, Libya agreed to dismantle its nuclear weapons program. The United States and the United Kingdom organized the removal of sensitive nuclear materials and equipment. In January 2004, a U cargo ship left Tripoli carrying approximately 25 metric tons of nuclear-related equipment and materials, including centrifuge components and uranium hexafluoride. The material was transported to the Y-12 facility in Tennessee for secure storage and eventual disposition. That operation was conducted with Libyan consent, which made the legal and logistical framework much simpler.
The Libya model doesn't apply here, because Iran is not consenting.
Without Iranian consent, any seizure operation is essentially an act of war. The legal justification would have to be built on self-defense grounds, that Iran's possession of near-weapons-grade uranium constitutes an imminent threat that justifies military action under Article 51 of the UN Charter. That's a difficult argument to make preemptively, especially if Iran hasn't actually weaponized the material. The international community has been divided on the legality of preemptive strikes against nuclear programs since Osirak, and the division has only deepened since then.
You're conducting an act of war, seizing material of uncertain form from a heavily defended site in the middle of a hostile country, transporting it through contested airspace to a facility that may not be prepared to receive it, and doing all of this under a legal framework that much of the world will reject. That's the credible option.
I didn't say it was a good option. I said these are the options that exist, and this is why the policy conversation has increasingly focused on alternatives that don't involve physical seizure at all. Sabotage, cyber operations, targeted assassinations of key personnel, and diplomatic agreements that trade sanctions relief for verified dismantlement. These are all ways to achieve the same objective without the enormous risks of a seizure operation.
Each of those has its own track record, and the track record is mixed at best. Stuxnet set the program back by maybe a year or two. Fakhrizadeh was replaced. Sanctions haven't stopped the enrichment.
That's the fundamental frustration. The non-military options slow the program but don't stop it. The military options might stop it but carry catastrophic risks. The diplomatic options require a level of trust and verification that simply doesn't exist between Iran and the West. There's no clean answer.
Let me ask you something from a medical perspective. You were a pediatrician. The UF6 gas cloud scenario. What does that actually do to a human body?
Hydrofluoric acid is one of the most dangerous industrial chemicals there is. It doesn't just burn the skin. It penetrates deeply and binds to calcium in your tissues, which can cause cardiac arrhythmias and death even from relatively small exposures. Inhalation causes pulmonary edema, which is fluid buildup in the lungs. You essentially drown in your own fluids, and the effects can be delayed. Someone exposed might feel fine for hours and then rapidly deteriorate. It's a horrific way to die, and it would affect children more severely because of their higher respiratory rates and smaller body mass.
The gas shield isn't just strategic, it's horrifying.
And I think this is the detail that gets lost in a lot of the policy discussions. When people talk about airstrikes on nuclear facilities, they're often picturing a building blowing up and that's it. They're not picturing a toxic cloud drifting over a city, hitting schools and hospitals and markets. The humanitarian dimension of the denial option is severe enough that it arguably makes the option militarily unusable for any country that cares about the laws of armed conflict.
Which loops us back to the ground raid, which we've established is barely feasible. So what's the actual consensus among people who study this? What would a real operation look like?
The most detailed open source analysis comes from a few think tanks and academic studies. The consensus, if you can call it that, is that a successful seizure operation would require a combination of approaches. You'd need a sustained air campaign to establish air superiority over central Iran, followed by a special forces insertion to secure the Isfahan site, followed by a heavy lift air operation to extract the material. The whole operation would take days, not hours, and would require at least a carrier strike group in the Arabian Sea, possibly supplemented by land-based air from allied countries. The idea of a quick in-and-out raid is not realistic for this target set. The distances are too great, the defenses are too thick, and the material is too heavy. You're looking at a multi-day operation involving thousands of personnel, hundreds of aircraft, and a level of coordination that would make the bin Laden raid look like a training exercise.
During those days, Iran launches every ballistic missile it has at Israel, at U bases in the region, at Gulf states hosting American forces.
That's the escalation risk. Iran has the largest and most diverse ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. They have precision-guided missiles that can reach Israel, they have cruise missiles that can target ships in the Persian Gulf, and they have a network of proxies, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, that would certainly activate in response to an attack on the nuclear program. Any seizure operation has to account for the possibility that it triggers a regional war.
Which is why the policy has been containment, not seizure.
Containment, sabotage, assassination, cyber, sanctions, diplomacy, the whole toolkit short of war. And the uncomfortable reality is that this toolkit has not stopped Iran from accumulating near-weapons-grade uranium. The latest IAEA reports, before access was restricted, indicated that Iran had enriched uranium to 60% purity, which is a short technical step from the 90% required for a weapon. The breakout time, the time required to produce enough weapons-grade uranium for one device, was estimated at just a few weeks.
A few weeks. So we're not talking about a hypothetical future problem. We're talking about a country that could, if it decided to, produce weapons-grade material faster than the international community could organize a response.
That's why the question of what form the material is in, and where exactly it's stored, is so urgent. If it's still UF6 gas in cylinders at Isfahan, the breakout timeline from that point is measured in weeks. If it's already been converted to metal and fabricated into components, the timeline might be measured in days or might already be at zero, meaning they have everything they need and are simply waiting for a political decision to assemble a device.
The intelligence gap isn't just an operational problem for a potential seizure. It's the central policy question. We don't know what they have. where it is, or how close they are to a weapon. And we're making decisions based on assumptions that might be years out of date.
That intelligence gap is not accidental. Iran has been systematically restricting IAEA access since 2021. They've removed surveillance cameras, denied access to sites, and stopped complying with the additional protocol that allows short-notice inspections. The IAEA's knowledge of Iran's nuclear activities is more limited now than it has been at any point in the past two decades. We are operating in the dark.
To summarize the options, ground raid to seize gas cylinders, at the extreme edge of feasibility, requires days of air superiority and perfect intelligence. Air-delivered seizure with heavy lift extraction requires a runway and a ground convoy through a city of 2 million. Destruction in place creates a toxic gas cloud that would kill civilians and trigger a regional war. And all of this assumes the material is actually in gas form. And actually it is Isfahan, neither of which we can verify.
That's the picture. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying these options are impossible. Military history is full of operations that experts said couldn't be done. The Israeli raid on Entebbe, the U raid on bin Laden's compound, the British raid on the Iranian embassy in 1980, these were all operations that required extraordinary skill, intelligence, and luck. But the scale here is different. This is not a building. This is a multi-site, heavily defended, geographically remote target set with a material that is hazardous to handle and a political context that amplifies every risk.
What about the transport question specifically? Say you somehow get the cylinders onto an aircraft. What happens next?
The transport itself is the least complicated part, technically speaking. UF6 cylinders are designed to be transported. They're shipped between enrichment facilities and fuel fabrication plants around the world routinely. They're certified for road, rail, and sea transport under international regulations. The challenge is not the transport physics, it's the security. You're moving nuclear material through international airspace or international waters, and you need to guarantee that nobody interferes with it. That means fighter escort for air transport or a naval escort for sea transport. And you need a receiving facility that's prepared for the material's arrival, which means advanced coordination with the destination country.
Once it's at the destination, what do you actually do with it?
The standard approach for disposing of highly enriched uranium is downblending, mixing it with depleted uranium to produce low-enriched uranium that can be used for reactor fuel. This is what the U did with hundreds of tons of Russian highly enriched uranium under the Megatons to Megawatts program. The UF6 is chemically converted to uranium oxide, mixed with depleted uranium oxide, and then fabricated into fuel pellets. The resulting material is useless for weapons. This is a well-established industrial process. The challenge is that it takes time. You're not going to downblend a significant quantity of material in a week. You need a facility that's set up for it, and you need to secure the material in the interim.
Even after a successful seizure, you're looking at months of secure storage and processing before the material is truly denatured.
And during those months, the material is a target. Iran, or its proxies, would certainly attempt to recover it or destroy it to prevent it from being used as leverage. The security requirement doesn't end when the aircraft leaves Iranian airspace.
There's a grim logic to all of this. Every step of the seizure option creates new vulnerabilities that the denial option doesn't have. The denial option, destroying it in place, is operationally simpler, but morally and politically catastrophic. The diplomacy option hasn't worked. The sabotage option only delays. It's a set of choices where every option is bad in a different way.
That's why the policy debate has been stuck for years. Nobody wants to accept the risks of military action, but nobody wants to accept the risks of Iranian nuclear breakout either. The result is a policy of managed tension, periodic strikes on proxy forces, cyber operations against centrifuge cascades, targeted killings of nuclear scientists, and a diplomatic framework that is formally alive but functionally dead. It's not a solution, it's a holding pattern.
A holding pattern only works if the other side is holding too. If Iran decides to break out, the holding pattern collapses instantly.
That's the scenario that keeps policymakers up at night. Not the slow, incremental progress that we've seen for 20 years, but a sudden sprint to a weapon, announced with a nuclear test that changes the strategic balance of the Middle East overnight. At that point, the seizure question becomes moot. You're not seizing material from a threshold state. You're disarming a nuclear-armed state, which is an entirely different and far more dangerous problem.
The window for seizure, if it exists at all, closes the moment Iran crosses the weaponization threshold.
And we don't know how close we are to that threshold. That's the intelligence gap again. Everything depends on knowing what form the material is in, where it is, and how close Iran is to a weapon. Without that knowledge, we're planning for contingencies we can't define.
That's the answer to the prompt, I think. The credible options for seizure, transport, and destruction all exist on paper. They've been wargamed, they've been studied, the military capabilities exist. But the conditions required to make them work, the intelligence certainty, the operational security, the political alignment, the risk tolerance for escalation, those conditions are not present and may never be present. The options are credible in theory and nearly impossible in practice.
I think that's right. And I'd add one more thing. There's a tendency in these discussions to focus on the technical and military dimensions and lose sight of the human dimension. The people making these decisions are aware that a failed operation doesn't just fail. It kills operators, it kills civilians, it triggers wars, and it accelerates the very outcome it was trying to prevent. The bar for a seizure operation is not, can we do it? It's, can we do it with high confidence of success and acceptable risk of catastrophic failure? And by that standard, I don't think any of the current options clear the bar.
Which is a sobering place to end up.
But it's also useful. Understanding why the options are bad is itself a form of clarity. It tells you where to focus your efforts. On intelligence, on diplomacy, on non-kinetic options that might change the calculus before the military option becomes the only one left. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word kelp entered English in the 1400s and originally referred specifically to the calcined ashes of seaweed burned for soda ash production. By the 1910s, Caspian Basin fishing communities had developed a specialized vocabulary for seaweed harvesting, distinguishing between driftweed gathered from shore and deepweed cut by boat, a distinction that never entered English but persisted in local dialects until the Soviet era.
Right. Right.
Deep weed, cut by boat. Something to sit with.
Here's the forward-looking thought. The question of what form Iran's enriched uranium is in is not just a military intelligence question. It's the question that determines whether any of the options we've discussed are even relevant. And right now, the international community is operating blind. Closing that intelligence gap is probably the single most important thing anyone can do, and it's not clear that anyone is capable of doing it.
On that cheerful note, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, this has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a question like this one, send it our way. We'll dig into it.
Try not to lose too much sleep over the answer.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.